Hi, Ken here. In nearly all of our podcasts, you hear students asking questions and their interaction with me. Many listeners find these exchanges illuminating because what is being asked is often exactly what is on their minds. If you find these conversations helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can maintain and expand our website. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, the nuts and bolts of Buddhist concepts 2.
Business about faith in the three jewels. Well, it's helpful here to have a proper understanding of the three jewels: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Buddha is the emptiness of our, or Buddha, let me not bring in too much Buddha's vocabulary right now, but Buddha points to the fact that we can't say what we are, that when we look at what we are, it's completely open. Needs a bit more gain on the speaker. Can you hear now, Anne? Is that better?
Hello.
Okay. Can you boost it a little bit? Yeah, it's right in front. Yeah. Is that good enough now?
That's much better.
Yeah. Can you hold it there, Steve? Okay. Buddha refers to this open, ineffable, indescribable quality of experience. Dharma refers to the clarity and vividness with which experience arises. And Sangha refers to the fact that experience arises without any restriction. Now, that's just how things are for us. So not to have faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha would, in a sense, be to contradict the fact that we experience things. It doesn't make any sense. So what I'm trying to point out here is that when, in the course of our lives, check in, bring attention to, how am I looking at things right now? For instance, when somebody, when we find ourselves opposing or in conflict with somebody, ask ourselves, how am I looking at that person? And if it's our partner or our child, at the moment that we're in conflict, we're probably not looking at them as they actually are. We're viewing them differently. We're viewing them in terms of what's being projected by our own emotions. In other words, we've fallen into, quotation marks, wrong view. And so just by the simple act of bringing attention to how we're looking at things in each moment, we'll find that the way that we're looking at the world begins to change. And it changes into the various qualities that I've described. We don't get that way by trying to look at the world that way. We get that way by paying attention to, or bringing attention into, how we are looking at the world in each moment. How we are looking at ourselves. Does this make sense to you? Okay. Let's move on to intention. Intention is usually described as renouncing what produces suffering or struggle in our lives. And this is very much based, or finds its origin, in the way Buddhism originally developed, which was as a way of people to practice who lived in monastic communities or who lived as hermits. And they were leaving aside the complexities of life, living very simply, and just leaving all that stuff behind. Now, for most of us, it isn't so easy. That way of life has its challenges, definitely, but you're reducing input very significantly, and thus and by intending to simplify one's life, then you live with less struggle. But that's not how it is for us. We live in this very complex world with many, many different demands. So I think the more appropriate way for us to practice is bring attention to whatever intention is operating in each moment. Now, when we do that, things get uncomfortable very quickly. Because we see that most of the time we are acting out of one reactive emotion or another. And we're not really acting with any intention. We are just reacting. And we live in a very interesting age where the whole economy is based on eliciting reactions in people. You know, if you go into a supermarket, or if you go into drugstores these days, you go into Walgreens or CVS or any of these things, how are the aisles situated? How have they placed the aisles? Well, they're at an angle to the door. Have you noticed that? They aren't straight up and down anymore. They're at an angle. And they're all different angles in there. Some are placed this way, some are placed this way, some are placed this way. And you go into these stores and you immediately get very confused and disoriented. And it is absolutely intentional. Why? Because when you're confused and disoriented, you're much more prone to just react and you'll buy things on impulse. That's why they've set these stores up. And you also notice that if you go into a supermarket, things are arranged so that if you need to bake a cake, you've got to go to almost every part of the store. You can't get all of the ingredients in one place. And the design is to get you wandering up and down the aisles where they have music to distract you again, putting you in a somnambulant state so that you will just react and buy things. And advertising is very, very much designed to elicit certain reactions. And you know whether you fit the profile or not by whether you connect with the ad or not, because if you don't connect with the ad, it's not intended for you. And everything is geared to eliciting reactions so that you buy stuff. Now, there's only one problem with this. We become inured over time to stimuli. And so the advertising or the marketing efforts have to become steadily stronger to draw our attention. And so our reactions will become stronger over time. And there's no way that this is sustainable over a long period of time. It basically leads to the disintegration of society because the economy is actively reinforcing reactive emotions. Very interesting system that has evolved, but I don't think it's going to work in the long run. Now, when we start bringing our attention to our intention in each moment that we live, very interesting things are going to happen. Several years ago, I had two people who came to me because they had built up sizable debt and they wanted to get out of debt using mindfulness. Okay. Well, I'm not a debt counselor, but it's not rocket science either. The first thing you do is you start tracking expenses, tracking everything that you buy. That's the very first thing you do if you want to get out of debt. And one person just started to do that right away, and the other person, it took them about 4 months of constant encouragement and reinforcement and me threatening to quit until they started tracking. In other words, they just started bringing attention to the action of shopping. And as soon as they did, their shopping patterns changed. because they started to get in touch with the intention that was operating. And they would go, oh, I don't really need this right now. And just tracking the what they were expending stuff on started to reduced the amount of their expending to the point that they were pretty well breaking even. That wasn't getting them out of debt, but it was stopping them getting further into debt, which is good. We'll get to those efforts later. Now, the next effort was to push that intention even further, or that attention further, so that they started to look at what were their priorities in their life as evidenced by what they were buying. And when they started to look at that, again, their patterns changed. And they thought there's whole areas that they didn't need to spend money on anymore. And that moved them to the point of being able to generate a surplus and hence moving out of debt. And both of them successfully moved out of debt, completely out of debt, in about a year and a half, 2 years. Then they had a real problem. They suddenly had much more money and they didn't know what to do with it. But that's another story. Now, when we bring attention to our intention, then we often discover that there are multiple things going on in any one instant. It's not just this or just this. We want to do this for this reason, we want to do that for that reason. All of these things are going on. And trying to figure out what the right intention is in all of that is impossible. Rather, and here we work with a principle that I call inclusive attention rather than exclusive attention. By including all of those different intentions, and just in the same way that I was talking about with respect to view, all of these different parts, by opening to that experience, so applying inclusive attention to all of those different intentions, a strange thing happens. They begin to sort themselves out. And something emerges and we know which direction to take. So you can see from what I'm describing, I'm not describing a process by which we're going to think things out analytically or rationally and figure out what the right thing to do is. We're bringing different kinds of attention, different qualities of attention to intention. And in that process, shifts take place. And we start acting in a different way. We start acting or intending things which are more in keeping, in balance with ourselves and our environment. They're realistic. They aren't over the top. They're respectful of everything in concern. And that's in the direction of right intention. So I've covered these two somewhat. Let's pause here for any questions you might have before we tackle the other two.
This question was submitted by Sharon from San Francisco. What does the term root guru mean?
Root guru is the usual translation of the Tibetan term Tsawe Lama. And there's a Sanskrit equivalent. It may be Satguru, but I'm not 100% sure of that. The meaning isn't absolutely precise. It has a number of different interpretations. But the principal one, and the most important one in my mind, is it refers to the guru with whom you feel the most profound connection,
the deepest connection, which is both has both a spiritual and emotional component to it. And in particular, it's the person who shows you the nature of your mind, usually in the series of instructions called the pointing out instructions. So those are the two principal ways meanings of the term root guru. It's the root guru you feel the closest connection with, and or it's the guru you feel the closest connection with, and it's the guru who shows you the nature of mind. Now, the reason it's called this term root is used is, and it could also be called source. It's the guru is described as being the source of energy. So the guru you feel very devoted to, that devotion is a source of energy in your practice, and through cultivating that devotion, then you transform that the energy of devotion into attention, which opens the possibility of direct awareness. And through the interaction between you and your teacher, that elevation or transformation of energy can be very, very profound. It doesn't actually require the presence of the teacher, but it's the presence of devotion in you, and it's practiced through intense prayer. It's also what makes it possible for the teacher to point out the nature of mind, because when we feel that kind of devotion, we're very open, and already the sense of self is let go of to a considerable extent, so it's much easier in that environment of devotion for one to see what the guru is pointing to.
This question was submitted by James in Northern California. What is the essential purpose of getting an empowerment? What does it do for the mind? Do you use empowerments in your teachings? I've had a few empowerments, and I'm wondering whether I should get a highest yoga tantra empowerment.
The essential purpose of an empowerment is to plant a seed of experience in your mind. Empowerment comes up most explicitly in the Tibetan tradition, in the Vajrayana tradition, where you're formally introduced to various meditation practices through the empowerment ritual, during which you and the teacher meditate together, and through the interaction of faith, compassion, and energy, the result is that a seed of the experience of whatever that meditation is about is planted in your mind. Most empowerments have to do with deity meditation, such as Avalokiteshvara or Chenrezig, the embodiment of compassion, or White Tara, or some of the higher tantras, such as Chakrasambhara, Hevajra, Vajrakilaya, and so forth. And the intention of the empowerment is so that you have some experience of being the deity, so that when you practice this, do this practice on your own, you can cultivate that seed of experience until it becomes, you have full experience of being the deity. There are other forms of meditation which have empowerments too, but that's the principal one. What does it do for the mind? It plants a seed of experience. So it gives you something to build your practice around. Do I use empowerments in my own teachings? To some extent, yes. Empowerments can be more or less informal, or they can be more or less formal. Most of the empowerments in the Tibetan tradition are given formally. But one can also take advantage of circumstances in life when there is the possibility of eliciting a moment of wakefulness in the student and planting a seed of experience in that. So that may mean clapping one's hands unexpectedly or saying something which throws open the mind, or just being with the student. So there can be formal empowerments and informal empowerments. In the Tibetan tradition, when they're talking about empowerments, they're by and large talking about formal empowerments in which one receives the transmission of all of the teachings and ideally all of the experiences associated with a particular practice. You say you've had a few empowerments and you're wondering whether you should get a highest yoga tantra empowerment. Well, there's no point in getting a highest yoga tantra empowerment unless you intend to practice that meditation. Getting an empowerment for the sake of empowerment is a bit like collecting baseball cards. You have a nice collection of cards, you may have a nice collection of experiences, but if you don't do anything with that, nothing really comes of it. The deeper the empowerment, the more responsibility there is on the student's part to actually make use of it. Because, as I said earlier, a seed has been planted in one's experience. And the seed may grow on its own. If you don't have a conscious relationship, that might create problems. So I wouldn't seek a highest yoga tantra empowerment unless you're very clear about your relationship with the practice, your relationship with the teacher, and what role spiritual practice has in your life.
This is from Bertrand in Morocco. There is an element of secrecy in the Tibetan tradition, and I've never read anything regarding the historical Buddha's life that touched upon this matter. I wonder where it comes from. Tantric practices? The Tibetan cultural background? Was it imposed by the social conventions and moral values of the time? Was it intended as a protective shell for the teachings? And if so, is this really necessary? Or was it supposed to be a tool for practice? In other words, where does the element of secrecy in spiritual practice come from, and what purpose does it serve?
Well, secrecy about certain practices goes back well before the Tibetan tradition. It was very prevalent in India. And you're correct in that it is connected with Vajrayana. Many of the Vajrayana practices find their roots, their bases, in sorcery practices, which were kept secret. Sorcery techniques were not openly talked about or taught. You had to go through a long and sometimes quite severe apprenticeship. When these sorcery techniques and energy transformation techniques were utilized for spiritual purposes, which is what Vajrayana is about, then that tradition of secrecy was maintained because for two reasons. One, open dissemination tended to dissipate the power and appreciation of the teachings. And secondly, these practices were to some extent dangerous. especially the energy transformation practices. And so the teachers only wanted to teach students who were serious, were not going to be confused by the practices, and had a very good basis on which to practice so they could actually use them. And basically, the whole notion of secrecy is based on an apprenticeship model, that you go through this apprenticeship, and when you've shown that you are worthy of receiving certain teachings, that you can actually use them, then you are given, they're given to you. How much relevance this has for the modern world, it's a question that I've thought about quite a lot myself, and I'm really not sure. Some people feel it's important to maintain the secrecy. Other people feel there's no point because everything's becoming more and more open anyway. I see people who take some of these esoteric teachings and do terrible things to themselves and get into horrible states of confusion because they aren't working with a teacher or someone who really understands what they're for or how they're to be used. At the same time, cloaking them in secrecy creates an in-group and an out-group and sets up all kinds of problematic dynamics, which I can't get behind either. So I think where we are now is a process of these teachings evolving and finding their role and the right way to be transmitted in Western society. But the secrecy did serve definite functions in the past. Whether that still those functions can be served in the same way in today's world, I don't know.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.